Yeah, so the last two parameters. In a sense, with the two of them, it's not immediately obvious why they're connected to building the Buddha land, which is the topic of this retreat. With all the other ones, they're more obviously external. Generosity, obviously, ethics to do with other people, patience, and certainly virya. But with meditation and wisdom, they're in a sense more, they can be seen as more internal. I mean, you meditate with your own mind, and wisdom is to do with the views we have about reality. But I think nevertheless they're quite important. They're certainly seen in Buddhism as quite central. But before I go on to them, just to remind us of the Bodhisattva ideal. I mean, we've talked about it a lot already, but just to give the foundation again. So a Bodhisattva is somebody who strives for enlightenment for the sake of all beings. I mean, that's the definition. And it's somebody in whom the bodhicitta has arisen. The bodhicitta is the will to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So it's the striving, the will to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. It's the Bodhisattva ideal. And it's a reminder of the altruistic dimension of the spiritual life. I mean, this Bodhisattva ideal was there from the early beginnings of Buddhism. Yeah. But just in Buddhist history, there came a point where it just needed to be emphasized again, yeah, because probably got forgotten. So what the Mahayana literature, the Bodhisattva literature does, it spells it out more clearly. So meditation and wisdom are huge topics. And I probably say more about wisdom than on meditation. On meditation, I was just going to talk about one or two aspects, specifically to do with the Bodhisattva ideal. Because we've been meditating for a while, we all know how to meditate, I assume, so all that's there. So I just want to talk about meditation and look at meditation in the context of the Bodhisattva ideal. So why is meditation important? Well, in Buddhism, mind is of central importance. Yeah? Mind is absolutely central in Buddhism. We had the reading yesterday in the puja from the Dhammapada, which is the first two verses. I'll just read them again. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. Yeah? If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. I've had that reading a few times already. But it's said again and again in Buddhism, the absolute centrality of mind. And that's the central thing in Buddhism. So it's important what we do with our mind. So obviously our mental states affect our surroundings. So that's why meditation works basically. And that's why we meditate. Yeah. Our mental states have an effect on our lives, our surroundings, other people. I mean, again, a point which was made a few times already. But maybe even more than we think. I think our sort of Western psychological scientific view of meditation is where we meditate, yes. We get into a good state and then we sort of get on with others and are able to cope with life. Yeah. I think that's usually how we see meditation. Yeah, we do something about our mental states and then when we meet other people, we're better at coping with them. So we do the metta bhavana, we develop loving kindness, and then we are better to sort of deal with people. We get on with them, we don't get into arguments and so on. But maybe that's limited. The traditional Eastern view of the metta bhavana is it has a direct effect. Yeah. So the way the metta bhavana is seen in traditional Buddhist society is that actually doing the metta bhavana has a direct effect on other people, on the people we're thinking about. It goes against our sort of upbringing and background, but I think it's quite interesting just to note that, and maybe interesting just to be open to the idea. I think if you try this, the meditation, next time you do the metta bhavana, just sort of, for the time of the meditation, assume what you're doing has an effect, directly. Yeah? It's interesting what it does to the practice. Yeah, so, yeah, our mental states may have a stronger effect on our surroundings than we think. Hope nobody gets paranoid, you know? I think it can lead to paranoia, be careful with that. Yeah? Yeah, but just assume our metta bhavana may have a direct effect on other people. Yeah, but as I said, I want to look at meditation in the context of the Buddhist, or I would call it bodhisattva literature. Yeah, so how in the texts dealing with the bodhisattva ideal, meditation is dealt with and covered. Again, when we come to meditation, our basic assumption is that it's something to do with ourselves. Yeah. I mean, everybody who learns to meditate is not surprised to hear about the mindfulness of breathing. Yeah. And we all assume, so it's things sort of ingrained in our thinking about meditation, it's to do with me. My breath, my mental states, my body. Yeah. I think that's a basic assumption we have about meditation. It's to do with myself. Yeah. Often when you sort of, when we then learn the metta bhavana or teach the metta bhavana, it needs some more convincing usually. So our basic assumption, meditation is about me. But that may not be the only way of looking at meditation. So I just had a look at how some of the bodhisattva texts talk about meditation. Give two examples. First one, already often quoted, Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. I think almost every speaker got it out at some point. I mean, that's the foundation for a lot of the bodhisattva literature. When I first read the text on the chapter on meditation is its longest chapter in there. There's chapters on all these different paramitas. Chapter on meditation is the longest one. And I must admit, when I first read it many years ago, I had great expectations about this, because this is great text on the bodhisattva ideal, very important text. Let's see what he says about meditation. And when I first read it, I was disappointed, because I thought, he doesn't talk about meditation. What he does is, first he talks about, I just sort of summarize it extremely now. Yeah, I mean, it's a long chapter, and I simplified a lot. First point, go on retreat. That's my wording. What he says in many other verses, get away from people. Go into the right conditions. Dwell in the forest. Yeah. The first one, external conditions. Go on retreat. For him, that is solitary, yeah, being alone. First one. Yeah. And that's sort of dealt with in many sort of verses, and he sort of spells it all out, how noisy people can be, how sort of they can disrupt your meditation, all that argumentative, everything can be. So just get away. Then, when you've done that, the mental withdrawal. Yeah, withdraw from worldly interests. I think what we would call fantasies. In a sense, it's not no good making the effort of going on a retreat and then fantasizing about home all the time. Yeah, I think that's what he's getting at. Just withdraw from that. Then finally, after all that, and that goes on for a long time, I mean, it's pages and pages, finally he describes meditation. And all he does is describes what I would now call versions of the metta bhavana. Yeah, so the only practice he describes as a meditation for bodhisattvas is the altruistic practice, the metta bhavana. He calls, it's sort of called in this context, it's called the equality of self and others. Yeah? So you see that, sort of basic truth, one is not different from others in the sense that one wants to be happy. I mean, you can summarize, you can approach the metta bhavana in that way. Yeah? Just see the equality of self and others. Yeah? Just quote a bit. At first, one should meditate intently on the equality of oneself and others as follows. All equally experience suffering and happiness. I should look after them as I do myself. Then later on. I should dispel the suffering of others because it is suffering, like my own suffering. I should help others too because of their nature as beings, which is like my own being. When happiness is liked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive after happiness only for myself? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not the other? Sort of like a summary of the Metta Bhavana, really. And then he goes a step further in the practice of the next step after you've done that. You practice exchange of self and other, where you put others even before you. That's the sort of violent method, the radical method of working on metta. You really go against the basic assumptions of I'm important, they're not. But the main point for me in it is when Shantideva talks about meditation, he only talks about metta, about compassion. Yeah? No mention of mindfulness and awareness of yourself. I mean, it comes earlier in the other chapters, but in the context of meditation, it's all altruistic. Another text, Gampopa, Jewel Ornament of Liberation. I think it hasn't been quoted yet on this retreat, so I bring it out. Gampopa was a Tibetan master from the 11th century, and what he did, I mean, they had all these different teachings in Tibet at the time, yeah, and he basically tried to put them all into one work. I think it's a similar project from Patrol Rinpoche. It's a similar kind of text, yeah? So they just try to get all these teachings and make them into sort of one thing, yeah? And Gampopa was probably the first one who tried this. Very influential text in Tibetan Buddhism, Jewel Ornament of Liberation. It's more systematic than Shantideva. Shantideva is more poetic, yeah? Gampopa is more, you can't read it, it's not bedtime reading. Yeah, it's sort of a bit dry. Just lots of quotes, basically. So Gampopa, too, has a chapter on meditation. Yeah, and in the chapter, he describes all the different practices. Yeah, so compassion, metta, mindfulness, different insights practices. Because he's quite thorough. Yeah, he just gives the whole picture. But the interesting thing in this chapter is the title of the chapter, which is I found surprising when I heard that. I mean, all translators call it meditation usually. Now, the Tibetan for meditation translates as stability of mind or stable mind. So the Tibetan words usually translated as meditation is stable mind or stability of mind. Yeah. But Gampopa uses something different. He calls it stability of aspiration, or stable aspiration. Yeah. Actually, one letter different in the Tibetan. Just like a little sort of play on words. And aspiration is the bodhicitta. So the title of what we would call meditation for him is being one-pointedly stable on the bodhicitta, on your aspiration to gain enlightenment. I just read his definition of meditation. The definition of meditative concentration is that it has the nature of calm abiding. The mind abides inside one-pointedly on virtue. He quotes in another text which says the mind abides on virtue. So it's certainly not just any one-pointedness or any concentration. It's concentration on virtue, on the good. Yeah. So you could say it's concentration on what's most essential for our lives. Yeah. Which again is a different way of thinking about meditation than from our usual way. Yeah. It's sort of not just any kind of concentration. Yeah. It's certainly concentration on virtue. And finally, a quote from, I forgot to check with from whom, one of Sangharakshita's teachers, I think it was Chatol Rinpoche, you can correct me. If you want to make your meditation more effective, do it for others. Mm. Was it Chatol? Okay. So if you worry about your meditation, you want to meditate better, do it with the intention you do it for others. In a sense, if you think about it, it's sort of obvious, you're less worried about yourself. And so worrying about oneself is usually what gets in the way of meditation. Yeah, so what we have in the Bodhisattva literature, a slightly different way of looking at meditation of what certainly I'm sort of used to. Yeah, I would sort of assume. It sort of goes against my usual assumptions about meditation. That's about me in the first place. The way they talk about meditation, it's about altruism and others. Might be interesting as an experiment on this retreat, just sort of when we have the 2 days of silence and we meditate more, just sort of remind ourselves that when we do the metta bhavana, it may have a real effect. And when we sort of sit down to meditate and we prepare, just remind ourselves of the fact that we do it for others. Might be interesting just to try it out and see what it does to our practice. Okay, so much on meditation and the Bodhisattva idea. Now the bigger topic, wisdom, or perfection of wisdom even, Prajna Paramita. I try to keep it practical, which is not easy with sort of slightly very deep topic like this. And some people demanded of me to put in quite complicated teachings, but I'm not sure whether I will do that. Okay, so why is wisdom, again, starting off with why it's important, why deal with wisdom? If mind is central in Buddhism, wisdom or views are even more central. I mean, just if you think of the central bit of the wheel of life, that was what drives samsara, what drives suffering, it's greed, hatred, delusion. And of the three, delusion is even more central than greed and hatred. So views are even more central. Because our views, and with views I mean all our attitudes, opinions of the way we interpret the world, the way we see the world, has a very strong effect on the way we live our lives. And often they are unconscious. Often our views come out in certain sort of behavior, or what we think of harmless remarks. So if you make a harmless remark and you think, what view lies behind that? And all sorts of assumptions. And they all have effects on our lives and the lives of others. And it's quite central in Buddhism to distinguish between wrong views, so assumptions, views about reality which are plainly wrong, which lead away from reality, and right view, which is in harmony with reality. It's very important to be able to distinguish between those views. In the first text in the Pali Canon is the Brahmajala Sutta. It's basically where the Buddha talks about 62 kinds of false views and where they come from and why they're wrong. That's the first thing the Buddha does. And interesting is when the Buddha criticized monks, it was often for them having a wrong view or entertaining a wrong view. And so when somebody had a wrong view and entertained that wrong view about Buddhism or the truth, he really criticized them. Yeah, this embarrassing situation, they're quite funny if you're not part of it. If you just read it, they're funny. Probably not funny for the monk. He was summoned to the Buddha and in front of all the others he was sort of criticized for having that view. So the Buddha certainly took views very seriously. Let's try to give a few examples of views. And also we may think that we take on Buddhist teachings, but to some extent we haven't really taken them on. Just an example. We all know that Buddhism teaches, non-enlightened existence, samsara, is not satisfactory. We all know that. We all learned that, first Buddhism courses probably. Yeah? So we all know not being enlightened is bound up with suffering, or at least with it's unsatisfying, unsatisfactory. Yeah? You can't find full satisfaction, lasting satisfaction in samsara, in the changing world. But then we make it the following attitude. Don't know if you have said, I have got this attitude. There's usually one issue, problem, or thing I'm concerned about. There's really one sort of problem. When this is solved, life is perfect. This is usually my attitude. Yeah? If I can only solve this one problem, it will be wonderful. Yeah, the next one usually comes up. But by having this attitude, I don't actually believe this. I believe the life could be perfect if I only solve this one problem, which I have now. If I only sort this one thing out, everything's okay. Yeah? This means I don't believe that samsara is not satisfying. I sort of believe somehow that if I only solve this one thing, life is perfect. Yeah, sort of heaven on earth. And I think it's quite a common attitude to solve the one problem. You've got this sometimes in groups, I think it's sort of psychological issue that when you work with teams, that's often somebody who is sort of, well, you don't like them, so difficult. Yeah? And you think if that person leaves, the team is perfect. Then you finally manage to get that person out, and the team isn't perfect. Somebody else takes that role. There's always something not quite right. But in our attempt, when we believe, if we only solve this one problem, life is perfect, we don't quite believe the Buddhist teachings. Another one is the view is that human beings are fundamentally evil and bad. It's not the Buddhist view, by the way. Yeah? It's sort of original sin. Yeah, I mean, on a conscious level, we all don't believe in original sin anymore because we think we all left that behind. But it may express itself, it may unconsciously, the view that human beings are selfish and evil may still come out in some attitudes. For example, suspicion. Yeah, so when somebody does something good, we sort of doubt their motives and think there might be something selfish behind it. Yeah. It can't be real if somebody does something noble and good. Yeah. So when we think, well, what's really behind that? Then we somehow still think man is bad, fundamentally, deeper down. Also, there's the view around that negativity is authentic and being real. Friendliness is being superficial. I don't know if you've ever encountered that. I don't know how common that really is nowadays, but I think I encountered it a few times. Yeah. So if you are friendly and positive, you're just superficial. You're probably just alienated from something. If you're just in a bad mood and you're grumpy, you're authentic. Yeah? I think so. So I think that the view is there, real is evil and bad. That's being real, that's how we really are. And this way one can, actually it's quite useful to have this view because you can glorify your bad mood into authenticity and being real. So it's something useful there for oneself. So the wrong view behind it is human beings are bad. It may also lead to a fear of there's some sort of fear in doing the metta bhavana because you're afraid you're alienating from something. Some sort of fear may associate with that. Yeah? You're afraid you're alienating from something more deeper in you by being positive. And again, the wrong view behind this may be human beings are really bad. So this is how views have an influence on us. Then there are some important ones. Well, they are important in a sense. Again, one of the most central Buddhist teachings is actions have consequences, karma. Yeah. So we all know actions have consequences. We've learned that often enough, heard it often enough. But to what extent do we really take it on? Example. Actions don't have consequences if nobody notices. That is not believing in karma. If nobody sees what I'm doing, I can do what I want. That is not believing in karma. Yeah. Or the another version, the one which I know quite well. Actions have consequences apart from the one thing I'm about to do now. Yeah. So I know it's not good to eat too much, but this one doesn't matter. Yeah. It means I don't believe in karma. In that moment, I don't believe in karma. I don't believe actions have consequences. Another one is because what we do in meditation, yeah, sort of getting into some fantasy, thinking that, well, I just follow this fantasy for a few more minutes, means in that moment, I don't believe actions have consequences. Yeah. In the moment, I think, it doesn't matter, follow that fantasy a bit more later on, I can come back to meditation. In that moment, I don't quite believe that actions have consequences. So this is not believing in karma, in actions having consequences. Fundamentally, it is said that the most deeply rooted wrong view is the belief in a fixed self. That's of I exist eternally, somehow in here. And also, I am the center of the universe. On a conscious level, we know that it's wrong, so we wouldn't dare to say that. Yeah. But I think this view comes out in all sorts of other ways. Just a few examples. When we are in arguments with somebody, I am always reasonable, they are always irrational. That's sort of a weird view about me, the fixed self, it is the center of the universe, which is always sensible and rational. There's also this other phenomenon, which is interesting. If you talk about work, different people talk about their jobs. I'm not sure how common this view is here, but I counted it quite a few times, is everybody seems to be surrounded by incompetent co-workers. Everybody thinks of themselves as being competent, reliable, responsible. Yeah? But everybody who serves many people, who talk about think about their working place, seem to be surrounded by incompetence. But nobody is incompetent themselves. Nobody ever says, actually, yeah, it's me, I'm not very good at my work. You hardly meet this. Yeah? So this is the fixed self view. If I'm the center of the universe, how I see the world is right. Yeah? This is how it expresses itself. There's the reversed one. I'm the worst one. I'm unworthy. Everybody can meditate apart from me. Another strange view. Yeah? They all can sit in the shrine rooms of this tradition and think, God, they're all meditating. They're only I'm not. Which is usually wrong. Yeah? Or we think we're in some funny way unique. Yeah? Like we have some hindrance in meditation and we think we're the only one who've got that. But it's actually not true. I mean, if you talk about meditation, I mean, all the different fantasies, hindrances, we all have them. Yeah, nobody has unique meditation hindrances. Yeah. So we heard it all before. In a way, yeah? So some way of us being unique, special, center of the universe, completely isolated. So that's the fixed self view. So, by the way, this lack of self-confidence and being I can't do it is the second form of laziness. I mean, yesterday when Lokesh talked about different kinds of laziness, mentioned sort of obvious laziness like sleeping, dozing, and then sort of laziness is busyness. But there's another kind of laziness, which is lack of self-confidence, you would call it. Yeah. So how can I practice? I'm such a miserable person, I can't do it. Gampopa calls that it's kind of laziness. It's interesting. So what we need to do, if we want to practice wisdom, and note I haven't started talking on the perfection of wisdom yet, yeah? Getting onto that later. The first thing we need to do is becoming conscious of our views. and really get them out. Because in a sense, we're often not quite clear that we have them. So just important, you can do it in discussion groups or on our own. It's easier to do it in a group, actually. Just to sort of become aware of the views we have about life. And just sort of get them out in a way, yeah, and then deal with them. And also, we need to practice right view. And on a certain level, the most important right view is actions have consequences, karma. Some texts say if you want to boil down right view onto one thing, it's actions have consequences. Just sort of concentrate on this and just sort of keep yourself reminding of actions have consequences. This is the most important view, which is in harmony with reality. And actions means, and I'm repeating what Subhadra said last week, is actions with body, speech, and mind. So what we do with our body, what we say, and what we do with our mind has consequences. And just keep yourself reminding of that. And if we do that, we probably notice when we try to find loopholes, exceptions. So actions have consequences. Which is another word for responsibility. It's quite interesting. Often when we talk about that, it happened in our group, it seems frightening. I think for many people, the basic assumption is this is frightening. Everything you do will come back to you. But it's also very positive and liberating. Because it means that we can take some control over our lives. So on that level, actions have consequences. Now, underneath all that, as I mentioned earlier, is the belief in a sort of fixed, autonomous self, which is this sort of deeply, deepest rooted wrong view. It's what we are born with, basically. I think the way it works is the deepest wrong view we have is the belief in a fixed self, which exists out of itself, it's of autonomous, yeah, and so it's the center of the universe. And it's eternal. It's unchanging. The belief in unchanging autonomous self is the deepest wrong view we have. This manifests as greed and hatred, as emotions. Greed and hatred manifest as more superficial views and opinions. So behind all our wrong views are usually craving and hatred. There's some connection there. Now, let's look at the area of the fixed self. It's a difficult one to get at. And the teachings which deal with the belief in a fixed, unchanging, autonomous self are the teachings to do with the perfection of wisdom. So now I come on to the perfection of wisdom. This is like reality as it is. The Heart Sutra, which we recite every evening in the puja, deals with that. Yeah. In the tradition of the perfection of wisdom literature, it's called emptiness. And what's meant by empty is that whatever is empty of independent self-existence. So it's not empty in a sense of it's not there. Yeah? Something is empty in a sense of it doesn't exist out of itself. So in other words, for a phenomenon to exist, there must be outer conditions. Nothing comes into existence without outer conditions. And nothing can survive for long without outer conditions. It's very simplified what emptiness is about. Yeah. Yeah, so everything you can think of, you can perceive, everything in your body, your mind, is changing. There's nothing fixed in there, absolutely nothing fixed, and nothing exists out of itself. If you stop breathing, your body stops existing. You need air from outside, you need food. It's the most basic example. Now, the teaching of the perfection of wisdom, there are certain dangers in that. I mean, I think that sometimes the Buddha said at some point that grasping the Buddhist teachings, the Dharma, at the wrong end, at the wrong way, is like sort of grasping a poisonous snake at the wrong end. It will kill you. Yeah? So if you grasp the Dharma at the wrong end, it's dangerous. And that certainly applies to the teaching of emptiness. The great danger is nihilism. If everything is empty, nothing matters. Yeah? If beings don't exist, we can kill them. That's not a theoretical problem. This argument is used. I mean, that's not a sort of theoretical idea I'm bringing up. Yeah. Yeah. So the great danger of this teaching is sort of it's understood in a nihilistic way. And what the Buddhist teachers have to say about that is, if you fall into that trap, you're spiritually lost, hopeless. As long as you believe that, all values go out the window. No more values. Yeah, you're out. To believe in karma, actually, you must believe in a sort of self. Yeah, I suffer the consequence from my actions. If you have a wrong view of I don't exist, it doesn't matter what I do. Yeah? So it's the great danger of the teaching on shunyata, on emptiness, is that it's misunderstood in a nihilistic way. Another danger, which is of less horrible, but probably more for a certain type of personality, more common, is that it becomes an intellectual game. Yeah. A sort of, you can get all into it, sort of philosophical implications, you get into science and all the scientific implications, you get into quantum physics, look at some popular scientific books and see all Buddhism in there, sort of, yeah. It becomes a bit of a sort of intellectual game playing. And you forget it's about you. It's not some sort of, it's not some abstract atoms which are empty. It's actually you. So when we recite the Heart Sutra, just to remind ourselves what it says, just the beginning. It's a different translation I'm quoting from now. Yeah. So, when we say form is emptiness and the very emptiness is form, emptiness does not differ from form, form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses and consciousness. Form, feelings, perceptions, impulses and consciousness is us. It's what we are. Yeah. It's not some sort of abstract thing out there. Yeah. Form is our physical, our body. Yeah. So when we say form is emptiness, emptiness is form, it means our body is impermanent. It's going to be older. Yeah. When the heating doesn't work, it gets cold. That form is emptiness. Yeah. It's dependent on outer conditions. Yeah. There's illness, we get ill. Yeah. It's not under our control. Feelings, yeah, they come and go. We feel good, we feel bad. Yeah, changes, nothing fixed in there. No reason, nothing to hold on to. Yeah. Perception or thinking, it changes all the time. Nothing to hold on to. Volition, I mean, it changes all the time. Yeah, what we want this, we want that. Sort of, nothing to cling to. So in all these, when we say it's empty, it means there's nothing to grasp, nothing to hold on to. Consciousness, according to one interpretation, consciousness is the idea, yeah, all that is changing, I know, my body is changing, my mind is changing, but behind that, that's the observer, that's not changing. Wrong, it's changing too. There's no observer, there's no behind my feelings, thoughts, fantasies, body. There's no fixed observer which doesn't change. Yeah, that's empty. Yeah. So it's not a theoretical idea. When we recite this text, it's not about some theoretical idea about life. It's the five things we cling to, the five things, well, us, where we get our security from, are empty. They are not sources of security. I'm going to read a different Perfection of Wisdom text, which spells that out clearer. Ratnaguna Samchayagata. In form, in feeling, will, perception and awareness, nowhere in them they find a place to rest on. Without a home they wander, dharmas never hold them. That's the bodhisattva, the practitioner. Yeah. So the Buddhist practitioner, the bodhisattva, doesn't find anywhere, doesn't find security, or doesn't look for security in these things, yeah, in what we usually grasp onto. So really, this should be frightening. Yes. Again, if we get away from the idea of this being some theoretical, interesting mental game in terms of life, it should sort of scare us. And to bear this, to bear reality, we need patience, kshanti. Again, Lokeshwara mentioned this third type of kshanti yesterday. I checked the Sanskrit word. It's anupatika dharma kshanti, which Sangrashita describes as it's sort of acceptance of the truth that all phenomena are in reality illusory, non-existent, unproduced, and undifferentiated. So it's to bear this reality, you need patience. It's, otherwise you couldn't bear it. And also the perfection of wisdom is, as the text says, for heroic spirits intended. Nothing, it's nothing to play around with. Well, you can sort of play around with, but it's only playing. Yeah. So what I suggest is, and then of course there are more complicated teachings. As I said, the teachings on emptiness, they get into all these very sort of complex philosophical discussions. And they can be interesting, they can be inspiring for a certain personality type, but they can be slightly sort of removed from experience, yeah? And you can get into the two types of emptiness, of self and dharmas, so, yeah, or you can see, oh, that's great, people love that. Buddhism itself is empty. Buddhist teachings are empty, it's great. Yeah, we all think it's wonderful, yeah? We don't need to cling onto Buddhist teachings. But before we come onto that, let go of yourself. That's the beginning, yeah? Then we can get into what we think the more exciting ones. And so the whole danger of getting into sort of mental game playing. Therefore, what I suggest, for practical purposes, forget about emptiness and go into something very basic, and that's impermanence. I mean, personally, I find impermanence as a very approachable way of looking at reality. Because there's two advantages to impermanence. You can't argue against it. I mean, nobody would dare doing it. I mean, we know everything's impermanent. You can't argue it. And you can't discuss it. There's nothing complicated about it, other than it happens. Yeah. There's no complicated philosophy in impermanence. Yeah. So when you look at reality in terms of impermanence, all you get is experience. Yeah. Because such a basic, simple teaching, I mean, probably if you're capable of doing it, you can make it complicated, but it's very difficult to do. Yeah. So for practical purposes, to look at the sort of emptiness of self, just look at everything you experience in terms of it being impermanent and changing. Yeah? Body is changing, or feelings are changing. So at some point earlier on, you were meditating, you had a certain thought, it's gone now. There's nothing left of it. Yeah? So I find impermanence much more practical as an approach to wisdom than emptiness. After having given almost a long talk on emptiness. So again, to boil down wisdom onto two teachings, or three points. One is, it's important to practice wisdom. It's important to become conscious of our views, and to practice right view, maybe it's enough to deal with karma and impermanence. Actions have consequences, and everything's changing. Maybe so these two things are almost enough to deal with. especially on retreat, where you sort of don't want to get into complicated mental activities. And the Buddha says somewhere, I couldn't find the quote, I don't know where it is, it wasn't one of those anthologies which doesn't give the source, a bit unsatisfying. That's samsara. He says somewhere that if you only look at impermanence deeper and deeper and deeper, you end up with in enlightenment. If you only all you need to do is going deeper and deeper and deeper into the teaching of impermanence. Yeah. Or in Sangharashita's words, there's no higher teachings, just deeper understanding. Okay, so much on meditation and wisdom. So to sum up, or to sort of end with some practical ways of approaching these two topics in the next few days. So we're going to have a few more days of meditation and silence from tomorrow, the day after tomorrow onwards. So just some ideas which you may want to sort of apply. In terms of meditation, just as a sort of mental experiment for 2 days only, if you will, yeah? Do it for others. Yeah. So a few minutes before meditation, just to remind yourself of the Bodhisattva idea. Yeah? And assume, just as a sort of, just be open to the idea that your metta bhavana may have direct effect. And for practicing wisdom, 2 teachings, actions have consequences and impermanence and change. Yeah? Just sort of stick to these 2 and just try to apply them to your life in the next few days. Okay, thank you.